Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the greatest pleasures I have as host of the morning show is my chance to speak with great, talented, thoughtful documentarians. And I have had the pleasure on several occasions of talking with John Maggio, who is responsible for a half a dozen superb films for the PBS series American Experience, including Billy the Kid, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Boy in the Bubble, Kinsey, The Fight, and The Lobotomist. His latest film for American Experience is called Bonnie and Clyde. And it says a lot about the subject matter of this film that we really don't have to say anything else to clarify who was Bonnie and who was Clyde. Just about all Americans, of all ages even, know at least something of Bonnie and Clyde and their infamous legacy. Actually, this film does a great deal to clarify exactly who they were, where they came from, what might have drawn them into their life of crime, how they figured in the landscape of a very, very colorful era, and much, much more. It's a superbly crafted film, and I am very, very excited to speak with John Maggio, who is writer, director, producer of this film. John Maggio, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I probably don't even have to ask why you wanted to make a film about Bonnie and Clyde. I can't think of a subject matter that would be any more irresistible than this. But did anything in particular sort of pique your curiosity about wanting to learn more about this famous couple?
Yeah, you know, I found them, it's funny, I have done other films on gangsters, mostly cowboy in the cowboy era, who were like Billy the Kid, who was a young orphan boy fighting for justice on the right side, but, you know, had gone wayward in a way, and Butch Cassidy, who was sort of thumbing his nose at the authority, robbing the big banks and the railroad men. And then Bonnie and Clyde had always sort of been on my radar because of the size of the mythology, as you say in your intro. You know, you can't escape it. But the difference they, in my estimation, was that they were so built up, but they weren't any, they didn't have any of these kind of Robin Hood qualities. You know, they were kind of killing the little guy and robbing from the little guy. And I thought, well, what's that all about? So I kind of wanted to dig deeper and really understand why it is we still talk about them.
So explain what you do when it's indeed officially going to be your assignment to make a film about Bonnie and Clyde. To what sorts of resources did you turn in order to flesh out this story? And in particular, to get behind sort of the fiction and myth that has surrounded these illustrious names.
Well, it's funny because one of the first things I will do, and I will do it only once, if there has been a film made about the gangster, I'm sort of curious as to what's in our national sort of consciousness. And of course, the Warren Beatty film in 1967, it was one of the biggest reasons why we're still talking about Bonnie and Clyde today. It was, you know, not unlike The Godfather with the mafia. This was a seminal film. It came at a point in time that there were mavericks in Hollywood making films. It was groundbreaking in many ways. They were beautiful people on screen. And so it sort of created the myth. But I wanted to see what that was. So I watched that and got a sense of, oh, yeah, I remember this now. It predates me a little bit, but I do remember seeing it on The Late Show, if people remember that. And so I backtrack from there and I think, okay, well, what's the real story? Who's still around? Who's writing? Who's thinking about Bonnie and Clyde today? And there was a gentleman named Jeff Gwynne who had just written a book, Going Down Together, and it unearthed a lot of new sort of interesting information about the pair. So I sort of turned to him first as a guide. And then he drew me into all of his resources, which included a lot of family members. and some family members of the police officers who were chasing him. So you start to kind of build a sort of broader sort of palette of ideas and of who these people are, and you try to humanize. I mean, the whole goal, of course, is to figure out, to give these people a little bit more of three dimension rather than just what we know from the movies and the newspapers. A lot of that did, what was helpful too was that the family was surprisingly objective about who these people were. I mean, they are still sort of upset that Bonnie and Clyde dragged their families through this kind of life. And their name had been marked for, you know, generations in Texas.
Hmm. We're speaking with John Maggio about his American Experience documentary, Bonnie and Clyde, airing tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. One of the things, Mr. Maggio, I especially appreciated about your film is that you don't just focus your attention exclusively on Bonnie and Clyde, but we also get some sense of the historic backdrop, the historic context in which they became so famous. Can you say a word about that, about this particular chapter in American history, which happens to coincide with some of the darkest years of the Great Depression? Why is it that that particular moment in our history is when some of these infamous figures in crime first came to prominence and became such a subject of public fascination?
Yeah, I think it's like anything. You know, it's just human nature. You know, this was a period in time, and Clyde came out of prison in 1932 and began his crime spree there. We're really sort of in the heart of the Great Depression, and especially so in Texas. I mean, there was crop prices had dropped, and it was a really, really dark time. Dust Bowl. I mean, there was a lot going on. And so I think what happens is, you know, these figures, these charismatic figures who are sort of thumbing their nose at authority a little bit. You get a guy like John Dillinger, who was so charismatic, became like a matinee idol. But he was robbing big banks. I mean, he was making big scores. He was part of a sort of more urban, modernized sort of crime scene. But he was far enough away to where people who were looking for some kind of something to pull themselves out of their doldrums could go to the movie theater if they could afford it, and they could see a newsreel about this charismatic guy who was doing what they couldn't do. He was thumbing his nose at authority. He was taking a shortcut to economic success in a way. And you have to remember that this was also being played out in the movies. I mean, Little Caesar and Scarface and the heroes at the time were people like Jimmy Cagney, who were these sort of charismatic gangsters who had lift themselves up by the boots and done what they could to find success, even if it was illegal, and they were killers, but they wore sharp suits and they always got the girl. And it seemed like the message was crime kind of does pay a little bit. This is before production codes were put in place after, by around 1934, when you couldn't show those sorts of characters as heroes in Hollywood anymore. But this is all pre that. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde are gone by 1934. So you see this capsule, there's this moment, it's almost like a vacuum, when we were so sort of down, we needed something to lift us out, and they're here with these sort of larger-than-life characters that were doing that. And Bonnie and Clyde, you know, at their funerals, thousands and thousands of people showed up because they had become so much, you know, they went as viral as you could go in the Depression era, because people wanted to sort of reach out and live that life. They were this sort of oddly, weirdly romantic Romeo and Juliet of the underground, of the underworld.
And a peculiar source of hope for people at a time when they desperately needed hope.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that we can never underestimate what that was like. I mean, we experienced something not too dissimilar in 2008 with our own sort of, you know, we're living through this depression now. We're sort of just pulling ourselves out of it. And look what happened. We had this proliferation of people who became famous just for being famous, because we want a distraction. We want to be able to distract ourselves from what's not so great in our own lives. And we have a real easy mechanism for that now with the internet and Twitter and everything. But back then it was newsreels and newspapers and crime novels and crime magazines. It's incredible when you look back at the true detective, true crime magazine, magazines were taking off. And it was all about this underworld that just seemed sort of sexy and romantic to people who really couldn't get their lives in order.
Hmm. And I think it's a great choice you make that your film opens with newsreel footage of the funerals of both Clyde and Bonnie. And we get a sense of just how enraptured much of the American public was with them and with their story. And
right.
just a minute or two into the film, we're told that they are famous for what amounted to a two-year crime spree. I think that's also kind of interesting in and of itself, that they could exact such a firm foothold on our fascination all these years later, and actually in terms of the amount of time they were actually prominently in the public eye was a rather brief one.
It wasn't. It was probably even more. I mean, that's the actual timeline of how long they were sort of on the road and committing, again, mostly car theft, petty crimes, robbing mom and pop stores, unfortunately killing some deputies along the way and some very innocent people along the way. But they flew mostly under the radar until 33, when the photographs of them are discovered at a crime scene in Joplin, Missouri. And they were essentially what we would call selfies today. They had taken a number of photographs of themselves with, you know, all of the classic photos of Bonnie holding Clyde up with a shotgun and her sitting on the edge of the car with a cigar in her mouth and looking completely unladylike for the period. And those photos, that film was undeveloped. It was left at a crime scene. The police got it, and they developed it and published them in the Joplin Globe. And then all the other newspapers picked up on it. And suddenly, there were there was this dark specter of criminality was spread all across the country, and people were transfixed by them. And within, you know, within a year that they're unfortunately, you know, captured and killed. And that was their undoing, you know, was their own popularity in a way, their own fame, that I think in many ways was something that Bonnie was craving. Clyde wanted to remain under the radar, but certainly was their undoing at that moment. It is fascinating. You know, it's incredible how, you know, that same kind of idea, the photographs going viral, are still what we're talking about today.
We're speaking with John Maggio. We are talking with him about his film, Bonnie and Clyde, which is airing tonight on the PBS series American Experience. John Maggio is a director, producer, and writer of this program. Before we start talking about Bonnie and Clyde, can I just ask you real quick about the matter of wearing those three significant hats in putting this film together? I know that it's been the case before, but what is that like? Is that, in a sense, sort of the simplest way to do it and yet the most complicated, since so much of the responsibility is yours?
Yeah, you know, I have a hard time. You know, I have a wonderful team of people. Lindsay McGrew is my co-producer on this film. We've got great editors and assistant editors. And so it's very much a team process. But when it comes right down to the content of the film and the directing, I have a hard time directing something I don't write. Because so much is in, you know, sort of imbued in the writing, and then I'll have ideas about how exactly I want to imagine those visually. One of the motifs that I was really into from the beginning for this film was the idea of, that you'll see in the film, is this sort of lonely car, this Ford V8, which is what Clyde prided himself on stealing. He always stole the fastest car, right, which were these V8 Fords that had just come out in 32. So I always in my head imagined them on the road. You know, this is very much a road movie. And so I wanted to make sure that it had that feel. So there's lots of things that are in my head that are just mine that I would have a hard time sort of articulating to a writer. So in many ways it's just easier. It is a lot of work, but I feel they go hand in hand. And I work very closely with my editor as well, who, you know, is a big part of this this process. So it is complicated, but, you know, I have no complaints. I love what I do.
Clearly. Say a word about the background of both Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker, where they were born and in what sort of circumstances, and how those circumstances, in a sense, suggest where they were each headed. Not that it was utterly inevitable, but what their earliest, youngest background says about where they ended up.
Yeah, like many gangsters, I mean, they grew up in abject poverty in the slums of West Dallas. It was an area that was referred to as the devil's back porch. It was so poor. Many of them were, Clyde was the son of an itinerant sharecropper who just ended up there after crop prices dropped and they couldn't make a living anymore. And so you, and Bonnie was the same thing. Bonnie was born sort of a semi-more affluent, kind of in a middle-class picture, but her father died shortly after her birth, and they were plunged into poverty as well and moved not far. They moved into Cement City, not far from the slums of West Dallas. And so that informs you. And the funny thing is about where they were is you could look across the Trinity River and see what you wanted. It was the opulence of Dallas at the time, you know, still a big cattle town, obviously. And it was all the things that they craved. You know, Clyde would see fancy suits. He'd go over there, and he'd see how the other half lived. And so I think that always drove him. But in his own mind, he was a clever guy. In his own mind, he just always believed that there had to be a shortcut. You know, he wasn't going to, you know, Clyde couldn't seem to keep a steady job. There weren't a lot of jobs to be had to begin with, but he certainly wasn't a 9-to-5er. And he saw that he wanted a shortcut to what he saw on the other side of the river, you know, and I get that sense. You can't, it has to be so tantalizing. And it was for them, and it was for Bonnie as well. Bonnie was, by all accounts, you know, a brilliant student. She was, you know, she was, her poetry is good. We have a lot of the poetry in the film. She becomes kind of this, the sort of bard of their whole crime spree, you know, all of her poetry. You can read into it quite a bit about what they were experiencing while they were going through this. And so I think that that's a classic story, right? The poverty they experienced was so abject. In Clyde's mind, it sort of rehardwired him to believe, this is my right. It's my right to steal these fancy cars if I want to have a life. And he always looked good. That was always, you know, important to a guy who was never more than, you know, 140 pounds maybe. I mean, and he wanted to impress people.
It's interesting how they are both dreamers and how their dreams are fueled by a couple of different things. In one way, Clyde's dreams of a better future are fueled by his ne'er-do-well older brother, Buck. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Bonnie Parker, one of the things that fuels her dreams of a different kind of life is her love of motion pictures.
Yeah.
And they provided what one of your guests in the program calls the roadmap to reinvention.
Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing, too. When we think about the power of cinema and media, it was just making its way to these back precincts, you know? Like, the idea of the cinema, you know, that Bonnie could escape West Dallas and Cement City and go and slip in and for an hour, 2 hours, see a world completely separate from the one she was living, where women had a certain amount of power. Remember, you know, the 1920s, coming off that period, women had power. They could be flirty. They could dress up. They could be who they wanted to be. And I think that Bonnie drew a lot from that. And, you know, we still do today. Again, I have to say, you know, who isn't sort of, you know, always striving for that next thing that we see that the media presents to them? And she was a particular case for her. She felt very strongly about movie houses, and even when they were on the run, they would always sneak into movies and watch movies. It's interesting.
She also makes an interesting choice of marrying at the age of 15, a marriage which was really pretty terrible. Do you think that left a lingering mark on her personally?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that was an opportunity to escape because he was also, the guy she married was also a little bit of a two-bit gangster, you know, high school dropout. And, you know, I think she was just looking for it, like anybody, or a lot of people, looking for that shortcut out. And as we know, and our parents have told us, there are no shortcuts in life. And there was one she took. Her mother didn't want her to do that. She was so promising. She was a promising student. But she dropped out. She got a tattoo of him, of Roy, his name was, on the inside of her thigh. I think she believed that this was her way out, but then he just starts disappearing. You know, he had a little bit of cash. He was a lot like Clyde. It was shortly after that she met Clyde. And she was drawn in by this is a universal scent of attraction. I mean, he had money, he had style, he had panache, he had swagger. And she was drawn in by that, of course.
Hmm. By the way, tell us about her journal and exactly where it was found or how it is that we have possession of at least some of it. Because you're right, it's a very, very helpful component in understanding who she was and who she and Clyde were.
Yeah, I mean, she was writing poetry throughout, and she would send poems over to her mother. You know, one of the funny things about this story was that you know, that I've always found hard to believe is that even when they were on the road and they were always being pursued by somebody, they would find a way to sneak back home. And they would, you know, it was a show in the film, they would drop a Coke bottle with a note in it, alerting the family where to meet somewhere outside of Dallas. And they'd go and meet, and they'd have a picnic, and they'd share things. And so a lot of her poetry was left with the family. And then some of it was picked up at crime scenes. Like in Joplin, there were pieces of poetry that were left behind in Joplin after they tried to escape. And then, of course, in the final scene, when they are when they're killed, a lot of her poetry is left in there. So it's funny, we get bits of it throughout their journey. There was a period of time when she was in jail, and she writes a poem called Suicide Sal. And in there you see that she's adopting all of the language of the movies and all the language of these sort of street toughs that she is enamored of. And you start to see this personality of somebody who believes that you have to stand by your men. Even though Clyde had gotten away and she ended up in jail for a brief period, she says you've got to stand by your man, and she's going to be that kind of woman. But it's all in this interesting poetic verse, so it's even more – it adds to the mythology, I think, of them, and you're sort of drawn in even more to try to figure out who this person is. So she's leaving clues throughout, kind of unbeknownst to herself.
And, of course, at that point, not long after her husband deserts her, which is probably the best thing that could have happened to her at that point, she crosses paths with Clyde Barrow at exactly the right time, it would seem, in terms of him being exactly what she was hungry for. And, of course, in many ways, the rest is history.
Yeah.
We have it's impossible for us to talk about every single facet of this pairing, but I do want to ask you about one story I knew nothing about, namely what happened to Clyde Barrow when he was in prison and suffering at the brutal hand of another inmate.
Yeah.
And you give this moment a fair amount of prominence in the film. Clearly, you believe it to be a very significant episode or chapter in Clyde Barrow's life.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, not unlike the poverty that he grew up in. I mean, this is a touchstone. This is an important moment when he is imprisoned and he is raped repeatedly by a guy named Roy Thornton, much bigger than him. I mean, Clyde was a very diminutive guy. And it's when he commits his first murder. He kills Thornton in prison. And that's almost not even, and somehow he gets away with it, which is, there's a little bit of a backstory to that. But he gets away with it, another prisoner gets blamed for it. But even that is minor compared to what he does to next. The conditions in this prison he happened to be in were so bad that in an effort to get out of having to do the work in the yard and in the fields that he was forced to do, he chopped off his own toe, which weirdly was not uncommon for prisoners at that time. Now, and he had a limp for the rest of his life. So in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, this is seminal. This is an important moment. And people talk about how they saw him change from a schoolboy to a rattlesnake overnight. When he came out of prison, he was just a changed person. And I don't think it's facile to say that clearly had shaped him from 1932 on. Some people, you know, it's hard for me to ascribe motive to somebody because, you know, they don't leave journals. Clyde was the engine of this quote-unquote crime spree that they went on. Some people believe it's revenge. He wanted to get back. He does eventually get back to that prison and break out some other inmates along this two-year period. But I just think he became somebody, he was a sociopath to begin with, and this took him over the edge, and he just didn't care anymore. He wanted to be free, but never wanted to go back to jail. He says that when he gets out. So, I mean, I can only imagine that really did shape the guy who came out of prison in 1932.
Hmm. Just say a word about the extent of this infamous crime spree on which they embarked with kind of a rotating cast of characters who, in a sense, comprised their gang, eventually primarily Clyde's brother Buck and his wife Blanche. How far did they go? What kinds of crimes did they commit? What kind of crime spree are we talking about?
Yeah, it's funny. It's pretty, I got to say, it's pretty petty crime, with the exception of the murders, which is what I've always had a hard time understanding what they're killing about. They basically were on a road trip. Clyde would steal these Ford V8s. they would be able to outrun a lot of the local police, who were often sometimes volunteer forces, and they would bring their own cars. So they were driving these jalopies, and Clyde had no problem outrunning them in these fancy Ford V8s he was stealing. They were stealing to survive. They'd go into a small town and knock off the grocery store, take what they want, and then hit the road. They never had any big bank heists. But, you know, they traveled all over. They traveled through Oklahoma. They traveled, I think, as far as Michigan. They were all the way down in New Mexico and all over Texas. It was pretty widespread. They just kept moving. And part of that was because before car theft was federalized, after it was in 33, 34, they could cross state borders and the police would just stop chasing them. So it was like they got a clean slate. So they were zipping over borders almost constantly into Missouri. Joplin, Missouri was a big haunt of theirs. So, you know, they're in perpetual motion, and it was just hard to catch them because they could outrun everybody. But it was, like I said, it was them living on the road, and it was an attempt for Clyde, I believe, at freedom. He didn't want to be tethered. He didn't want to be hanging down. And if anybody got in his way of that, they'd end up, you know, he had this massive arsenal of guns and ammunition. He would just shoot his way free.
And most of the time they were much, much better armed than the law enforcement officials who were in pursuit of them.
Right, that's right. And that's the other big part. I mean, he was breaking into armories all over the Southwest and taking armor-piercing bullets. He had a Browning automatic rifle. And a lot of these, a lot of the police, unfortunately, had 22s or shotguns and were just no match. I mean, those Browning automatic rifles were very, and still are, incredibly powerful.
One thing, though, I so appreciated in this portion of the film was when somebody stepped in to say, let's not over-glamorize what this experience was like, particularly towards the end when things begin to go badly. But it is so easy to kind of romanticize what this crime spree felt like for them, and that it was one long, exciting joyride. Your film does a good job of reminding us that this was also a crime spree that meant a bit of tedium and frustration, and of course, ultimately, it leads to a very, very bad end for the two of them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it was this life on the road, but they couldn't stay in one place for more than a night, if that. They were bathing in streams. They were eating, you know, out of tin cans or eating whatever they could get. There's a moment in the film where, you know, they have a really bad accident, and Bonnie is incredibly injured, you know, burnt, and it couldn't walk. And so there is no romance to their crime spree in that regard. And, you know, to top it off, I mean, they're killing innocent people. You know, they're killing a guy that tries to stop them from stealing his family's car. They're killing these deputies who, as I said, sometimes were volunteer, you know, and just stepped in, were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So there's such an ugly side to this whole sort of mythology, the Faye Dunaway, Warren Beatty mythology of who these characters were, that it's important to remember all that, as you say.
Mm. A last question. As you mentioned early in the interview, your film is really distinguished by the presence and cooperation not only of some experts, but also of some members of the extended family of Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker. Just say a word about what it was like to speak with them and what you think this project meant to them personally.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Some of them were reluctant, and therefore I think the one that was most reluctant was Bonnie's niece. And she gave us, I thought, the most interesting insights, because she could remember her mom talking about when Bonnie and Clyde would come in and they would have, you know, their mother would make, you know, after struggling to take care of raising Bonnie and, you know, as a single mom in Depression era Texas, was pleading with her to come off the road, was pleading with her to leave Clyde. And she talked very sort of openly, I think, and honestly about how, but two things, how disappointed she was in Bonnie that she did that to the family, but also the sort of undeniable bond that Bonnie and Clyde had. And the whole family talks about that in this weird way. about this love, because Clyde did look after her. After there's a moment in the film when as I had mentioned, that Bonnie gets severely burned, and Clyde is carrying her around the country in the middle of this crime spree while they're on the run, and taking care of her. And so they are sort of kind of mesmerized and very moved by that love, but also feeling very much like, you know, they brought a lot of harm to the family and the family name.
It's an extraordinary story, and of course, at the time, in terms of the extent of their crime spree, they weren't as significant as some other important figures of the day. But when it came to the public's fascination, there was no question. Bonnie and Clyde were the stars of the crime landscape of that period, and to this day are vividly remembered. Any of us interested in knowing more about Bonnie and Clyde need to look at your marvelous film. Bonnie and Clyde will air tonight on PBS, on the PBS series American Experience, on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and across the country. John Maggio, I congratulate you on yet another superb film, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
And the time is 8:41. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Well, for as much as I love being on the radio, the next few minutes are going to be, in some ways, a bit frustrating, maybe more frustrating for you, the listener, than for me, the host, because we're going to be talking about an absolutely extraordinary book, visually speaking, and I wish so much that this medium allowed me to hold up to the microphone some of the incredible images that are captured in this book called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary. It comes to us from the good folks of National Geographic, and they've produced all kinds of really astonishing work over the decades, but I don't think I have ever enjoyed a book more than this spectacular collection of some of the most amazing photographs ever taken. My guest for the next few minutes is Stephen Alvarez, who has been a photographer for National Geographic since 1995. So this serves as a lovely 20th anniversary present to himself, in a sense, although it's not just his work that appears in this beautiful work. But Stephen Alvarez has actually done his work all over the globe, and he has been selected to write the foreword for this book, in which he recounts a couple of the most important moments in his own considerable career as a photographer and photojournalist. And I am so excited about this opportunity to speak with him about his work and about this marvelous book. Again, it's called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary, and it is published by National Geographic. Stephen Alvarez, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, Greg, thank you for having me on this morning. It's great to talk about my career and about this book that I'm really so excited to be included in.
It's really something else. And by the way, the cover of the book includes the name Susan Tyler Hitchcock. Could you explain to us who she is and her role in putting this book together?
Well, she was the primary editor on the book, so she helped, along with a great number of other people, assemble the images and assemble how they would be structured. And it was after that process started quite a bit that they asked me to come in and write a foreword about what the photographer does and about what I've done and what the role of the photographer is at National Geographic Society, but really in society in general.
And we'll get to the book itself and some of the incredible images in just a moment. Let's find out a little bit about your own background, and let's start with where this interest in photography began for you. I mean, how far back in your life can you trace this interest?
Well, one of my first memories, Greg, is someone putting a Brownie camera in my hand when I was just a few years old and me taking my first photograph. So photography has been part of my life forever. And I knew fairly early on that I wanted to be a photographer. It wasn't until college that I really developed a sense of what that would mean. But I realized as soon as I had a camera in my hand that I could say almost anything in the world I wanted to say, and it was a great way to explore the world, and that I had something to contribute as a photographer.
Was National Geographic your first significant professional gig, or did you have significant photographic work before National Geographic 20 years ago?
I had a 5-year career as a national magazine photographer before I began working for National Geographic. So I've always lived in the Southeast, and for the longest time I was the go-to photographer for a New York magazine that wanted something done below the Mason-Dixon line. So I shot a lot of portraits, a lot of editorial portraits, shot a great number of photo essays for Time and Life when it still existed, all the financial magazines. But it was National Geographic that I was always really after, because they would let a photographer explore a story in a way that I found very interesting. You know, to spend 6 months or a year on one subject is a great privilege, and it's always been my interest.
What can you tell us about the transformative nature of your work as a photographer over the last several decades, given the incredible breakthroughs in technology? And I want to ask you also about the way in which our sort of understanding and appreciation for photography has changed as well. But let's begin with your work as a photographer. In what ways has that changed the nature of what you do and how you do it?
Boy, but photography has always been a technical medium, and every advance in photography, in just the technology of photography, leads to a different way people see. Wet plate to dry plate, to glass plate, to color, to big format cameras, to small format cameras. Each time there's a change, photography changes, and I can't believe the changes I've seen over my career. I started in film, shooting 35mm color slides, and that makes you work a certain way. Color slide film is very difficult to expose, and so much of the job there was just purely technical. If you could make a well-exposed image, that was an awful lot of skill that was involved in that. And the lighting was very different because color slide film is very slow, so I needed a lot of equipment in the field all the time. Film cameras are very fragile, so you need a lot of cameras. And the change from film to digital has been tremendously helpful for me, especially going into really remote places and photographing, say, a cave environment where it's physically very daunting to be in there. The digital technology has been fantastic for me there. The immediate feedback of what my lights are doing changes the way I work tremendously. The increased sensitivity to light changes the way I work, because I need fewer lights and I can work in a much more natural and proactive fashion. So The changes in technology are astounding. Digital cameras I never saw coming, and they are just so good. They see light much more like my eyeball sees it. So it's been a huge blessing for me as a photographer.
I suppose if there's a drawback in that, it's maybe that we as the general public, perhaps to some extent, might be tempted to take photography for granted, since it's something that is sort of with us all the time, and we are forever snapping shots of this and that and selfies of ourselves and so on. Do you sense that, or is it the opposite, that in fact it opens up all of us to think about the art of photography?
Well, I think that the ubiquity of cameras now, and I'm mostly speaking about smartphone cameras, because there are so many of them, and we're all photographers now. I think that's an incredible thing, because so many people participating in photography has raised our visual literacy tremendously. As a species, we're producing an unbelievable number of photographs. I think we made 1 trillion images last year. However, that means that now 2 billion people are involved in photography every day, not just receiving it, but in making it. And that's a real change in how we communicate, but it's also a change in the literacy. So I find that we have a bigger audience now as photographers, because people appreciate it, an image that cuts through the clutter of the other 1 trillion images. So much.
We're speaking with...
I just think it's a great thing. It's a really exciting time to be a photographer with all these people participating in the medium.
We're speaking with Stephen Alvarez, a National Geographic photographer. He contributed a foreword, and several of his wonderful photographs are part of an amazing new book from National Geographic called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary. You begin your foreword by talking about a couple of the most intriguing experiences which you have had as a photographer, including in 2006 an expedition to a very remote part of New Guinea in the South Pacific, in which you entered an absolutely amazing cave. And for you, it sounds like it helped crystallize for you the purpose of the kind of photography that you do. Tell our listeners about this experience.
Yes, in 2006, I was part of an expedition to the island of New Britain in Papua New Guinea. So really the opposite pole, part of the world from where I am now. And what we wanted to do on this expedition was explore a number of caves that had never seen much visitation. And I've always loved this idea as a photographer, as explorer. And we found a cave room that was very, very difficult to get to. It was almost a 12-hour trip to get to the room itself. I had to go down a rift and swim up a river, all in complete darkness. And the room itself is extraordinary. 4-acre emerald green lake, 120-foot golden ceilings, 30-foot waterfall on one side, and then passages way back that are just extraordinary to see. And to be there as a photographer and realize that more people have stood on the surface of the moon than have been in this cave room, is just being there is extraordinary. But then to make the image that carries that experience back to a general public is that's really the role of the photographer, is to go into the world and either see something new like we had seen there, something that no one had ever discovered before, or see something in a new way and explain that. And that's what I've always thought our role is to go out into the world and interpret it either by through its newness or through its through just looking at things differently.
Hmm. In your foreword, and by the way, one of the most spectacular pictures you took on that photographic exhibition immediately follows your foreword, and it is a jaw-dropping photograph indeed. You also mention in the foreword an incredible privilege you were granted by entering, in a sense, one of the most restricted places on Earth, another cave, a very, very famous cave, but nevertheless a cave no one ever gets to see, but you got to see it and you got to photograph it. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, a lot of times at National Geographic, the images are the product of tremendous and long planning. And we had decided to do a story about the first artists. And it was really a story about why people started making art. And one of the things I knew I wanted to photograph were the oldest figurative paintings on Earth, or so the oldest. And they're in a cave called Chauvet in southern France. And Chauvet, as you said, is one of the most restricted places on Earth. The French government is very serious about the conservation of this cave because the paintings are 36 millennia old, and they don't want to mess them up. So it took 2 years of asking and begging and pleading with the Ministry of Culture in France to finally get access to the cave. And in the end, they gave me 6 hours. So they said, you can go. You will take 3 trips of 2 hours each. And the place is, I don't think Fort Knox is as well guarded as Chauvet is. You actually enter through a submarine door that's been bolted onto the side of the mountain. And it's, but you step inside a time capsule. And inside this cave, eons melt away. And standing in front of those paintings is a mind-boggling experience, because here on the wall are paintings that are very well preserved. And the artist, who's been dead for 36 millennium, is speaking as clearly to you as if they were standing in the same room. And that compression of time is, and that feeling of history is just tremendous. And to be able to make images in there that in some way transmit that experience is a tremendous privilege.
Mm. And if we turn to page 204 in this book, we see at least one of the incredible photographs which you took on that day. And we we share your sense of wonder, even though we are only, in a sense, secondhand visitors to that place. Explain to our listeners how this book is put together.
The book is put together by chapter, and what we've done is broken it out to phenomena, life, places, objects, and moments. And of course, there's some overlap in between them, but the idea was to have things grouped by, you know, what they are, and to give some sense to it that way. And each of the images is accompanied by a extended caption and that the photographers all contributed to. So you not only get to see the image, but in some way the thoughts of the photographer when they were capturing it.
Stephen Alvarez and the book which we have been talking about, a spectacular one from the National Geographic, is called Rarely Seen, Photographs of the Extraordinary. Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my interview with Christina Vela, who has written a fascinating book about a very, very important American, and one we do not know enough about, George Washington Carver, a superb scientist and humanitarian. Her book is called George Washington Carver, A Life. You'll hear our interview on tomorrow's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for a sunny but cold day. We're headed for a high today of 13 degrees. It will cloud up overnight with a 50% chance of some light snow and a low of 9 above. A 50% chance of light snow tomorrow morning as we warm to a high of 23 degrees, 26 on Thursday, 29 on Friday and Saturday, up into the low 30s by Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.